Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. With today's nomination of Chuck Hagel for Secretary of Defense, we'll begin with an analysis of Senator Hagel's evolution from a loyal Republican soldier to a fierce critic of the Vietnam and Iraq wars, which he concluded were wars of choice based on lies. John Judas, a senior editor at The New Republic, who profiled Chuck Hagel in an article, Look Back in Anger, The Unmooring of Chuck Hagel, joins us to describe the war hero turned heretic whose nomination the neocons and his former Republican colleagues are determined to block. Then we'll examine the choice of John Brennan to be the next director of the CIA, with a former member of the CIA's clandestine services who retired in 2007 as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats. Glenn Carl joins us to discuss the role of torture that is reported to have scuttled Brennan's earlier chance of getting the job, and how that issue, which has been revived by the movie Zero Dark Thirty, will affect Brennan's confirmation. Then finally, we'll look into the possibility of minting a platinum coin with a $1 trillion denomination to be deposited in the Treasury in the event that the Republicans again hold the debt ceiling hostage and shut down the government. John Hilsenrath, the chief economics correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, who covers the Federal Reserve, joins us to discuss this gimmick endorsed by Paul Krugman and the possibility it will be used. Joining us now is John Judas, who's a senior editor at The New Republic, an active member of SDS and the left of the 60s. He taught philosophy at Berkeley and at the San Francisco Art Institute. His books include The Folly of Empire, The Emerging Democratic Majority, and The Paradox of American Democracy, Elites, Special Interests, and the Betrayal of Public Trust. He wrote a profile of Chuck Hagel in The New Republic, Look Back in Anger, The Unmooring of Chuck Hagel. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Judas.
Yeah, hi.
And John, your article, which you wrote at the time Chuck Hagel was thinking of running for president, and he of course withdrew in a rather strange way. He would have challenged, of course, John McCain in the primaries. Is that the source of bitterness? Because McCain, Hagel was in many ways a protege of McCain in the Senate, but clearly he is not supporting his nomination as Secretary of Defense.
Oh, the source of McCain's bitterness? I think that comes a little earlier. Yes, they were very close in the 1990s. There was a kind of a caucus of McCain, Kerry from Nebraska, Hagel, a few more people, I guess later Reed joined it, of people who had fought in Vietnam. And Hagel was his co-chairman in the 2000 campaign, but they broke over the Iraq War, and they did that before Hagel really thought about running for president. It was at about 2005, 2006, when Hagel realized that that this wasn't going to be a something that was going to be resolved through negotiations multilaterally, the UN, but it was an invasion very similar to Vietnam, and that it was going to result in a similar kind of disaster. And he became a critic. McCain was continually a defender, remains a defender to this day, and that's really the source of the antagonism between the two men. I mean, they made some nasty comments about each other at the time also.
And at the time, Hagel did an article for Esquire magazine and an interview with George Stephanopoulos where he raised the specter of impeaching George W. Bush.
Yes, he didn't actually say that he would wanted him to be impeached, but he sort of implied that it would be understandable if people tried to impeach him. Yes.
And that, of course, was at the time of where the U.S. was deeply mired in the Iraq War. What I find fascinating about the profile you did of Chuck Hagel, Look Back in Anger, The Unmooring of Chuck Hagel, is how he and his younger brother, Tom, went into the Vietnam War and by some bureaucratic accident ended up in exactly the same unit.
Yes.
And that He was a rifleman. He actually volunteered to go to Vietnam rather than spend 6 months in West Germany. And the brothers fought together, and then in Saigon and in the jungles and during the Tet Offensive, and at different moments, each saved the other's lives. And in the spring of 1968, when a mine, I'm just reading from your article, when a mine went off under their armored personnel carrier outside of Saigon, Chuck Hagel pulled Tom out with blood pouring from his ears. And then the ammunition started to cook off inside the carrier, burning Chuck Hagel severely and blowing out both of his eardrums. What subsequently happened after the Vietnam War is fascinating, that the brother Tom was tortured by guilt over the people he'd killed and seen killed, and he believed that the war had been a waste and was immoral. And it was quoted here in your article, "To the day I die, I will be ashamed I fought in this war." And he became a law professor and is a liberal Democrat. His older brother, Chuck, stayed with the belief that it was the noble thing to do. But then at the time that we're talking about, that critical time during the Iraq War in about 2007, 2008, he started to have deep reservations. And Chuck Hagel then read every book available on Vietnam. He went back to his Vietnam experiences to revisit it, and that appears to have informed his break with the Bush administration and the Republican Party.
It was actually a little earlier. It was sometime, it was even late 1990s or early 2000s. He was always fascinated by Vietnam, and he had read before. When he came back, he read extensively, but he thought it was it was a bad idea, but one that had to be carried through. I'd say that was his view of it. Then he heard this oral recording of Lyndon Johnson talking to Senator Richard Russell in the beginning. I think it was 1965, where Johnson said in effect to Russell, "This is going to turn out very badly, but I can't go down as the first president to abandon a war." And what Hagel concluded from that was that he had really fought in order to he had fought in Vietnam, and all these people had died because Johnson had fears about his political reputation, and that the war really wasn't something to save democracy, but it was something that was perpetuated out of a fear of failure by a president. And it was that the recording, listening to that recording, that really turned him and made him reconsider the Vietnam War. And he carried that attitude into the beginning of the debate about Iraq. And even he supported the resolution in October authorizing force if necessary, but he had been assured by Powell that the United States was going to do everything it could to get the UN to go through with the inspections to see if it could be resolved that way. And if they had to go to war, it would be similar to the first Gulf War, where it would be championed by the UN. There would be a big coalition, and it would be completely different from the kind of thing that did occur. And when we did go in unilaterally, when it did occur, just as when people didn't greet us as liberators but occupiers, Hagel turned against it. So that's the story briefly of his.
Sure. John Judas, I recall the tape of Johnson talking to Senator Russell, and in the tape he talks about, he said, "I got this sergeant here on my staff. He's got a bunch of kids. He's about to go over there. I don't know what we're fighting for there." It's unbelievable to recognize that the President of the United States knows what a complete quagmire and waste of time Vietnam is, and yet he feels compelled to continue the war because he's afraid of what it will do to his presidency if he pulls out. Where at the time of the Iraq War, Chuck Hagel, of course, I think this is why the neocons hate him so much. When he's talking about the weapons of mass destruction and the idea that Iraq possesses nuclear weapons, he told Newsweek, "It's increasing It's interesting to me that many of those who want to rush the country into war and think it would be so quick and easy don't know anything about war. They come at it from an intellectual perspective versus having sat in jungles or foxholes and watched their friends get their heads blown off. I try to speak for those ghosts of the past a little bit. Do you think he's going to carry that with him, assuming he gets the job as head of the Pentagon?
Well, he'll carry it with him. You have to recognize that the Secretary of Defense is not all-powerful. The president's going to make the decisions. But I think that Obama's willingness to nominate Hagel, which surprised me because he doesn't usually walk into these kind of conflicts, indicates that Obama has some doubts about unilaterally going after Iran. And that would be the next step: Vietnam, Iraq, now Iran, where we would attack another country that was not planning to attack us, and possibly get involved in another big war. So I think that there's a message there about Iran and about Obama's willingness to play ball with Netanyahu in Israel, who seems to want us to do their bidding in Iran.
So would that explain then, John Judas, why the neocons and their friends over here this whole idea of trying to say that he's somehow anti-Semitic or not sufficiently supportive of Israel because of comments that he made to Aaron David Miller, saying that a lot of people on Capitol Hill are intimidated by the Jewish lobby, which is about as controversial as saying that the sun sets in the West.
Yes, that's true. It's not controversial. Everybody says that. And it's true. And I think what's interesting is that that Jewish liberals and conservatives are to a great extent divided on this. J Street, the other pro-Israel organization, is supporting Hagel. Most of the organizations that have opposed him that are associated with Israel are organizations that are either close to the Netanyahu government or even to their right and don't believe in any two-state. They believe in a kind of greater Israel that would incorporate the Palestinians or send them off to Jordan.
Well, but my question, John Judas, is the reason that the Israeli pro-Israel hawks and the neoconservatives who brought us the Iraq War and who are going to the mat opposing Chuck Hagel and Lindsey Graham and McCain and others, is it because they feel that as Secretary of Defense is somehow going to prevent them from having their war against Iran?
I think that's right. I think some of the people who are against him are legitimately fearful that he is going to hurt Israel, damage Israel. I don't think that's the case, but I think that I think that there are people who believe that and for that reason oppose him. I think there are people who want to screw Obama and think that they can beat him on this on something the way they did on the Rice nomination, and that's why they're opposing him. So I think there's a multiplicity of motives involved.
Again, I'm speaking with John Judas, who's a senior editor at The New Republic, and he wrote a profile of Chuck Hagel in The New Republic back in 2007, Look Back in Anger, The Unmooring of Chuck Hagel. This profile explains his evolution from being a fairly loyal Republican soldier to a fierce critic of both the Iraq War and of the Vietnam War, in which he served and won two Purple Hearts. So then the question then arises, John Judas, how is he going to get the votes? I mean, there's some Democrats who are wavering, Chuck Schumer, for example. What's the president going to do to weigh in here? Of course, it's different from floating a name than actually nominating somebody. So what's your sense of what it's going to take to stop this attempt to block Hagel's nomination?
I'm not a good one to ask. You should ask somebody from the Congressional Quarterly or one of those places. I would worry myself, but I assume that Obama and his people did some head counting before they did this. I'm sure they did that with the Rice nomination, and that they think that they can get Hagel through the Senate. But I would worry that the Republicans would decide that this was a united front issue, and then all they would need would be, 9 or 10 Democrats, and it would be all over. So I don't know. This I think it's going to be a battle.
Well, you would think that that Hagel himself can make a pretty strong case for himself, can't he? And he's already said that all of these attacks on him, he hasn't been able to answer them, and now that he can, so I take it that will be the next step, right? That he'll make himself available.
Yes, and he'll answer questions, but. It just depends how much of a fuss the Republicans want to make. I would suspect that the Obama people think that they can get him through, but I just don't. I don't know. I think a long time ago in 1977 there was a guy named Paul Warnke who was up for being head of the Arms Control Agency, and the neoconservatives blocked him. People are going to try to make this a kind of demonstration project. Whether they succeed or not, I just don't know.
Well, but history and reality is on the side of Chuck Hagel, is it not? I mean, the Vietnam War was a catastrophe. The Iraq War was a catastrophe.
History was on the side of a lot of things. History is on the side of having a stronger stimulus program and not cutting the budget when you're in the middle of a recession. History was on the side of not going into Iraq in the first place. But we do screwy things in this country. Right? I mean, we sometimes ignore these lessons.
Well, then, but why do the neocons have any credibility? I don't understand it.
I don't understand it either. I think you have to watch those Freddy Krueger movies, Nightmare on Elm Street, where the guy keeps coming back. You know, they think he's dead each time, and then after 13 episodes, he's still around. I don't understand it. I think they have some money behind them. I think they're articulate. I think for a long time they've had the Israel organizations, but fractionalizing within that coalition, and you have you have people like Tom Friedman coming out for Hagel. So I think it's going to be more difficult to form that kind of alliance in this case.
Well, again, I'm speaking with John Judas, a senior editor at the New Republic, who profiled Chuck Hagel in the New Republic in an article, Look Back in Anger, The Unmooring of Chuck Hagel. Tell us about Chuck Hagel's relationships to some of the people who actually tried to stop the Iraq war. Brent Scowcroft, the national security advisor under Bush's father, for reasons which I'm still mystified about, Bush's own father did not counsel the son against the war in Iraq. He let him go ahead and make that massive blunder. I don't know whether at that point Brent Scowcroft and Bush Sr. knew that Dick Cheney and Don Rumsfeld were running the presidency, and the kid didn't know what the hell was going on. But the long and the short of it is, Scowcroft is close to Hagel and represents that foreign policy which they refer to as principled realism, as opposed to the reckless utopianism of the neoconservatives. Give us a sense of who's going to come to, in terms of the foreign policy establishment, who's going to come to Chuck Hagel's defense?
Well, I think that the people you named already have. There's a whole group of them, former State Department, National Security Advisors, Scowcroft, Brzezinski, Frank Carlucci, Carla Hills, who was U.S. Trade Representative, Thomas Pickering. He was he's ambassador to Iraq. There's a whole group of them.
Colin Powell too, right?
Hmm.
Colin Powell.
Yeah. Colin Powell has come to his defense. Yes, that's true. There's a group that signed a letter. That's what I was trying to think of in my mind. Powell wasn't part of that, but yes, independently he has defended him. Within Washington, there is a lot of former foreign policy people who think the way Hegel does, or vice versa, who have influenced the way Hegel thinks. Scowcroft, you know, was against the Iraq War. In August 2002, he wrote an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal counseling against it. And he in the last 10 years, he and Brzezinski have worked together. There are several what you call study groups that have formed around these ideas of United States doing things multilaterally, not trying to impose its will upon countries, particularly in the Middle East, and trying to achieve some kind of reconciliation between the Israelis and Palestinians, rather than leaving it up to the two parties to fight it out by themselves. And Hegel is very much part of it. He signed these groups. He signed these reports on both Israel and Palestine and on Iran that took positions that have angered the neoconservatives, but that are not unrepresentative of how a lot of people in Washington think.
Well, I think if you really polled the military, the rank and file, the guys in uniform, you'd find that they pretty much all of them would support Hegel, and particularly the stand that he's taking about the dishonesty of politicians using soldiers as victims of their own political ambitions and dishonesty. I think that, it's the neocons and these guys that have never been near the battlefield that seem to be appearing on television all the time. In the real world, there's an awful lot of people in the military and in the Pentagon who I'm sure admire Hegel and will support his. Not that they have a voice on television. That's the problem, right?
Right, and they don't necessarily have a vote in Congress either. So,
yeah. So
we'll have to see.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here, John Judas.
Sure, it was a pleasure.
Again,
bye-bye.
Again, I've been speaking with John Judas, who's a senior editor at The New Republic. He's an active member of the SDS and the left in the 60s. He taught philosophy at Berkeley and at the San Francisco Art Institute. And his books include The Folly of Empire, The Emerging Democratic Majority, and The Paradox of American Democracy, Elite Special Interests and the Betrayal of Public Trust. He wrote a profile of Chuck Hegel in The New Republic, Look Back in Anger, The Unmooring of Chuck Hegel. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back in a moment. Talking about the nomination of John Brennan to be the next head of the CIA.
Oh no, oh well, I ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Yes, war no more. Well, I ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Gonna lay down my hymn. Down by the riverside, down by the...
The movie makes another chance he takes. Odds are he won't live to see tomorrow. Secret agent man, secret agent man. They've given you a number and taken away your name.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Glenn Carl, who was a member of the CIA's clandestine service for 23 years and retired in March of 2007 as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats. He's the author of the recent book, The Interrogator, An Education. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Zero Dark 30, Torture is the American Way? Welcome to Background Briefing, Glenn Carl.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Glenn, the president announced today his nominee to be head of the CIA, John Brennan, who has apparently served closely beside him for the last 4 years. This is the second shot at that job for John Brennan. Back in 2008, he withdrew his nomination or withdrew his name because of largely from criticisms from liberal groups about the choice. What do you think his chances are this time around?
Well, I don't think I have a particularly good record or insight into tea leaf reading for Capitol Hill. But I do know John Brennan well, and I think I know the issues well enough, of course. I think very, very highly about John Brennan. He and I have worked together in previous years on terrorism issues. I felt at the time, in 2008, that he was the unfortunate victim of misunderstanding, actually. I know John and his views and his conception of how to conduct counter-terrorist operations and his devotion to the oath of office. And I think he was unfairly tarred with having been a supporter of enhanced interrogation techniques. In fact, to my knowledge, that the opposite is the case, actually, and John's a principled man with nuanced views. So I would hope that the odds are very high, and I don't think one could find a better candidate, frankly, to be a director of Central Intelligence.
Well, apparently, Brennan, in a letter to Obama back in 2008, when he withdrew from consideration for the head of the CIA, said in the letter that he was a strong opponent of many of the policies of the Bush administration, such as the preemptive war in Iraq and coercive interrogation tactics, including waterboarding.
Yeah. Yes, I know that for a fact. John and I were working together from 2003 to 2007. That's correct. In my experience, that is correct. He was a victim of the moment. And having been a senior intelligence officer during the years when those events, those activities occurred, so he was tarred with association in that way, which I suppose is unavoidable, but was not just. It was not did not correspond to reality. When I know in-house John to have fought the good fight many, many times.
So the other issue, of course, will be the use of drones and targeted killing. And the American Civil Liberties Union have voiced concerns over Brennan's nomination today, saying the Senate should not move forward and clear this nominee until it is clear that this nominee will end its targeted killing program. What are the chances of that happening?
Well, it sounds like, two things I'll comment on there. It sounds like deja vu all over again in a way. You change from enhanced interrogation techniques, which should be called torture, to the drone issue, and then the ACLU's position is the same as that which happened 4 years ago with respect to John's candidacy. I think that's an error again. The ACLU and I agree on many things, but on this one I think that they're misplaced in their views. The drone campaign, or the use of drones as we've done it for a number of years now, is a sensitive, controversial one. That's, there's no question about that. It does raise issues of rule of law, habeas corpus, and due process, and so on, particularly with respect to Americans. I would argue, frankly, that the Obama administration is getting it right on the whole, which is that it is legitimate to consider certain hostile actions by a non-state actor as an act of war. And I think the United States can legitimately defend itself by killing people in certain instances. I know for a fact that the controls and measures to make sure that we get the right target and do not kill innocent people, if at all possible, are rigorous. Will errors occur? Of course. But I know that the measures are rigorous. I don't deny that there are legitimate debates to be had on this, but I think to tar John Brennan with the issue and to deny him the DCI position as a result would be an injustice itself. What is my prediction for how he'll get through the process? I think that this time around, the people on the Hill should look at 4 years of dramatically greater nuance in our counterterrorism policies, a total repudiation conceptually and almost organizationally down to the individual case officer level of how the war on terror was conducted. Counterterrorism operations were conducted under Obama as opposed to the war on terror under the Bush administration. And John Brennan is responsible for much of this, and I think he's a man of nuance and understanding and should get the nod if people know what they're doing.
Again, I'm speaking with Glenn Carl, who was a member of the CIA's clandestine service for 23 years and retired in March of 2007 as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats. He's the author of The Interrogator and Education, and he has an article at the Huffington Post, Zero Dark 30, Torture is the American Way? Question. So, Glenn Carl, given that the issue of torture will come back, and already Senator John McCain has said that he wants to revisit that role, it's interesting that now, last time around, John Brennan got attacked from the left in 2008, and now he'll be attacked both from the left and from the right with John McCain. Now, John McCain, of course, will ritually attack everything that Obama does. I mean, this is a very bitter man who lost the presidency in 2008 to Obama and seems to have spent every waking moment since finding ways to frustrate and diminish Obama's ability to govern. And he seems to be acting out of a rather petty bitterness. But nevertheless, he still has some influence there in the Republican caucus. What happened, though, with Morrell? He was standing there, the deputy director of the CIA, who took the job after Petraeus's ignominious departure. He was standing next to Brennan when the president introduced him, and then Morrell actually introduced Brennan before he spoke. And the LA Times is reporting on Monday that maybe Morrell lost his chance of getting the job because of his association with the filmmakers of Zero Dark 30. So that strikes me as something of an odd irony.
Irony is a good thing because I think it helps us maintain sanity and detachment a little bit, but it doesn't help us too much if we're the officers who are victimized by the ironic perceptions and events. I don't know the facts firsthand. I have heard also that various powers on the Hill were angered that senior people, I guess Morrell is the one in question, had spoken with people involved in making the movie Zero Dark 30. That would be poorly considered, but you know, if someone wants to stop you, then you can almost come up with any pretext. I have seen the movie, and I limited my comments in the little piece I did in Huffington only to the issue of how torture is portrayed and the way people will perceive it. Not to the accuracy of the movie itself as a whole. I'll be writing a piece on that soon. The movie is remarkably accurate. It's shocking. I lived this. I did this. And in fact, they were quoting me at various times. Not that I spoke to nobody. I want to get that on the record. It's amazingly accurate in how things were portrayed. So did Morrell talk, and should he pay a price for it? I think that would be harsh, but I suspect that that's what's happening. And Washington's a tough place.
Well, I think specifically the Senate's on the Intelligence Committee sent a letter to Morrell last Thursday. It was apparently a sharply worded letter demanding him that he explain his assertion in a December 21 message to CIA employees that, in quote, some information leading to Al-Qaeda chief bin Laden came from detainees subjected to enhanced techniques. So that seems to be the objection, because as you know, Glenn, Senators McCain, Levin, and Feinstein wrote a joint letter to the head of Sony Entertainment, the studio that's distributing Zero Dark 30, complaining about the film. So apparently, specifically, I guess, for Feinstein, since she's the chair of the committee, is complaining to Morrell that he told the CIA employees that the torture did work in part.
This is a mystery to me, why Morrell would do that. You know, if we become lawyerly for a moment and we look at the wording, information from detainees subject to enhanced interrogation techniques contributed to finding Osama bin Laden, I'm sure that that is true. That doesn't say information obtained through the use of enhanced interrogation techniques led to the capture or the killing of Osama bin Laden. So I think maybe the President Clinton nuance might be involved in the statement. I don't know every report. I obviously did not attend and take part and participate in every interrogation of every high-value target, but I was involved in the program, and subsequently, for years, I was a recipient and an assessor someone assessing the validity of the intelligence obtained from detainees. And I can tell you that, as far as I knew, when I retired in 2007, every report obtained under duress had been formally recalled as not trustworthy, and that the information that led to Bin Laden did not come from enhanced interrogation, a point which is made in the movie, 0.30, if one watches carefully. The information was obtained from a detainee who was subject to enhanced interrogation by using normal interrogation methods, not from using enhanced interrogation methods. So it is, I am bemused and distressed that an American official would say that torture has produced useful information. And even if it had, that would obscure the argument, and here I would agree with McCain, Feinstein, and Levin, that this is not even a debate we should be having. No American official should be ever supporting, under any circumstance, the use of enhanced interrogation. So I just find that, frankly, shocking and mystifying and wrong.
Well, I think probably what's going on here, Glenn Kyle, is that a lot of people, probably more so in the Pentagon than the CIA, but certainly in the CIA, are concerned that the film will be shown abroad, which it obviously will. And if a cartoon in a Danish newspaper or the accidental burning of a Quran in Afghanistan could create the kind of backlash in the Islamic world, this film, you know, is pretty disturbing. And I think that's probably what they're worried about, aren't they? That this is just
those are legitimate concerns, and it's an outrage and a stain on us forever as a nation that we did this. This should be acknowledged and common knowledge to everybody in the United States. But it's a fact.
Right. Well, I know.
It's horrible. And so is enhanced interrogation. Not as horrible as Abu Ghraib, but horrible.
Right.
It is a fact. The truth hurts, and tough luck for us.
Well, of course, but it would make more sense then to put Dick Cheney on trial rather than Catherine Bigelow. I mean, there's a... Naomi Wolf has written a piece comparing Catherine Bigelow to Leni Riefenstahl, which is an absurd notion.
And for goodness sake, that's just nonsense.
Yeah,
that's
she's just...
You know, no. I can tell you that Bigelow's film is disturbing and is... I lived this. This is my life. This is my career. And down to the way my computer looked and what was behind me as I typed and how I spoke... This movie gets it right. There are things that it doesn't get perfect. There are some, you know, you can only do so much in 2.5 hours. But this does portray the truth. My concern was that by implication, it spreads, it promulgates inadvertently, I believe, the big lie, which is that enhanced interrogation is in some way acceptable, or did actually play a positive role. And that is not the nuanced message the movie makes, but that's what the average viewer will take. And as you point out, unfortunately, rightly, foreigners certainly will leap upon this as proof that, you know, we are horrible torturers. And the fact is that we did that stuff, and we will pay the consequences a long time. But to denounce Bigelow for that is frankly stupid or in poor faith.
Again, I'm speaking with Glenn Kyle, who was a member of the CIA's clandestine service for 23 years and retired in March of 2007 as Deputy National Intelligence Officer. He's the author of the recent book, The Interrogator and Education, and he has an article at the Huffington Post, Zero Dark 30, Torture is the American Way? So back to John Brennan's nomination announced today by the president. Obviously, he's not going to have as tough a time as Chuck Hagel. The knives have already been sharpened for some time by the neoconservatives and by...
saying Hagel's a fine public servant also.
Yeah. Well, I think it's... You got the bitterness of John McCain, who really had a falling out with Hagel. Hagel was pretty much his protege in the Senate. And in 2008, Hagel considered running for the presidency against McCain. So some bad blood there, but... Again, this is not about the right person for the job and the Senate doing its duty of advise and consent and vetting nominees. This is sort of political payback, isn't it? And I mean, do you accept my premise, Glenn Kyle, that it seems that both Lindsey Graham and John McCain have just have this jihad against Obama from day one, and anything he does.
Absolutely, I do. Of course, you know, McCain and I am a co-signatory with a letter. I don't think it's the same letter you just alluded to, with Senator McCain denouncing torture recently. So on that subject, he and I are of like minds. I think that might be the only one I can think of, just about. And I find him not to be a deep thinker on public issues, but to be an ardent one, and to be a partisan one. And it's quite clear that I'm a little surprised that Lindsey Graham is playing the attack dog when he sometimes is a more thoughtful public figure. But the Republicans consistently, as everyone who reads the papers, I think, should see, have taken the position that their job is to oppose President Obama. That strikes me as a bizarre conception of the serving the public interest, but that seems to be what's happening.
So what do you think, then, are the chances? I mean, I know you said you don't read the tea leaves, but after Petraeus, who was the darling of the conservatives, and of course he blew up in their face, and I don't know whether you heard the Fox News tape of Fox News trying to recruit Petraeus to become president of the United States and run against Obama, either in 12 or in 16. It's unbelievable. I mean, it's true.
Well, I know that I hadn't heard that, but I knew in 2007 that that many viewed him as the next President MacArthur, as it were, and that he was an ambitious man, although certainly a talented one. I haven't heard the most recent thoughts, but you know, everyone likes a man in the, you know, the hero on the white horse. So.
Right. Well, he's the guy that saved Bush's bacon with the so-called surge. I mean, Bob Baer, recently I spoke with him, and he said that he thought that the CIA were perfectly happy to get rid of this guy because.
Well, I agree with Bob. Sure. Yeah, yeah. I do agree with Bob. Yeah. That
he was dumped on them to get him off the street, so Fox couldn't recruit him.
You know, Joe Kennedy was sent to the Court of St. James in the 1940s because he was a potential presidential rival of Franklin Roosevelt. So there's a long tradition of putting important people in jobs that send them on a sideways trajectory from the presidency. So, I think that was what was happening in part.
Well, just in closing, Glenn Carl, do you think then that we're going to have a real debate on this terrorism issue and the use of terrorism and the stain against the United States? I mean, my big objection to it in terms of foreign policy is that every two-bit dictator around the world now can get a free pass, you know, whether it's Mugabe or Assad in Syria saying, well, you know, the Americans do it. I think the damage is extremely deep and lasting that's been done. But is there any way, you think, for us to heal ourselves and maybe put Dick Cheney on trial, for God's sake?
Yeah, well, this is something I've thought about a great deal, and I don't think there's no easy solution to it. But to me, the answer is acknowledge your failings, speak them openly, and embrace them, and not to lie and not to dissemble. We did this. This is a stain. We should say that we did this, and it is a stain, and it does not define us. It was an aberration, and here is how we will live up to our ideals and embody them, which, on the whole, the United States has. In this instance, we did not. That's the only thing I think we can do, because otherwise we will add hypocrisy to error and to sin, if you want to call it that. So I think that's all you can do. It is hard to live down Abu Ghraib or enhanced interrogation. It contradicts what America is supposed to stand for. Now, should we try Cheney? I personally have found, have come to the position that one of America's strengths is to look forward and not to look back and seek vengeance, or in this instance, even justice, that it would be as divisive and probably more so than it would be constructive and healing. So I don't support that, although I think what he did amounts to a usurpation of the Constitution and our laws.
Well, Glenn Carl, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thank you. Anytime.
Again, I've been speaking with Glenn Carl, who was a member of the CIA's clandestine service for 23 years and retired in March of 2007 as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats. He's the author of The Interrogator and Education and has an article at the Huffington Post, Zero Dark 30, Torture is the American Way? Question. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about how a $1 trillion platinum coin might stop the Republicans from shutting down the government again. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is John Hilsenrath, the chief economics correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, where he's responsible for covering the economy and the Federal Reserve. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Hilsenrath.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
And, John, there is this idea that's being floated out there about the idea that we could mint a $1 trillion platinum coin. And it could be deposited in the Fed in the case that the government was shut down, and it could be used without doing any harm and causing inflation. I believe it's the mechanism by which the government has the right to do this is largely to do with these commemorative coins. But this gimmick now is getting the endorsement of people like Paul Krugman, the New York Times columnist, and Nobel Prize winner for economics. So what's your sense of the surreal becoming real?
Oh, I don't think it's going to happen, but it certainly has caught fire in the last few days in the blogosphere. I'll just give you a little bit of background. So the problem that we face here is that the nation, once again, is bumping up against the debt limit. This is a statutory limit that Congress imposes on the government's ability to issue new debt. Debt limits have been in place since 1917. They usually get raised, but they've turned into a hair trigger for debate between the Congress and the White House over budget issues. There's a chance that Congress will refuse to raise the debt limit, which would create a problem because the government runs on debt. We spend more money than we raise in revenues, and it wouldn't be able to pay its bills, basically. So the idea that's being floated around, again, mostly in the blogosphere, is, if the government can't issue any additional treasury securities, treasury bonds, it does have the right, through a statutory quirk, as you said, to relating to commemorative coins, that allows the Treasury to print coins. And the idea is that they could print a $1 trillion coin, deposit it at the Fed, and have the Fed credit the government's account with $1 trillion of cash to pay its bills. It's an outlandish idea, but in this outlandish fiscal world that we live in, it's getting a lot of attention right now.
Well, John Hilsenrath, it's getting some attention, not just in the blogosphere, though. Congressman General Nadler has right. suggested it's a good idea. And on the Republican side, Representative Greg Walden, a Republican of Oregon, is introducing legislation that would ban President Obama and the U.S. Treasury from minting platinum coins to avert the debt ceiling standoff.
Right. So in addition to the blogosphere, it's getting some attention on Capitol Hill, but I just can't see it rising to the level of policy. Let's talk a little bit about the implications of doing something like this. If the Treasury were to go down this road of printing a platinum coin, what it would effectively be doing would be dragging the Federal Reserve into the middle of the fiscal debates that exist right now between the White House and Congress. The Fed chairman, Ben Bernanke, has told Congress there's nothing that the Fed can do to prevent a catastrophe if the debt limit isn't raised. He's been basically begging Congress to raise the debt limit. If the Treasury did something like this, they would be basically forcing the Fed to print money to fund government operations, which is something that I certainly would expect that the Federal Reserve would be very much against.
Well, but I think the fact that Bernanke is saying what he's saying, and apparently people aren't listening to him. I mean, we've already had this before, where the full faith and credit of the United States was used in a kind of hostage negotiation, and the consequences were the downgrading of U.S. Debt, which means that it costs us more to finance and service our debt. So people who are actually supposedly interested in or concerned about deficits by this mechanism, all you do is increase the deficit.
Well, I think if the United States Treasury printed a $1 trillion platinum coin, we could certainly expect to be downgraded again.
whose face would be on the coin, by the way?
well, yeah, I guess
maybe John Boehner.
You know, I think the lesson to take here, and what's so striking to me, is that we have some really outlandish ideas that are being thrown around. The platinum coin is one. You know, there's also the idea of a constitutional challenge along the lines using the 14th Amendment of the Constitution to unilaterally declare the debt limit unconstitutional. The Treasury has looked at a lot of different ways around this situation. They've looked at the idea of selling some of their gold stockpile. They've looked at selling off mortgage securities. There are no good solutions. There's actually, I take that back, there is only one good solution to this situation. It's the solution that neither side seems to be willing to broach, which is a compromise between Republicans and Democrats to reach a long-run plan for managing government finances and government debt. That's actually the approach that Bernanke has been begging, the Fed chairman has been begging Congress and the White House to take since the financial crisis, to devise a sustainable long-run plan for the debt. You know, it's the case that the debt probably isn't a problem in the next few years, but certainly going out 10 years or so as the baby boomers age and healthcare costs rise, it becomes an enormous problem, and now is the time to be thinking about it. Compromise is the only good solution, and unfortunately, it's the one that both sides seem least prepared to engage in.
Again, I'm speaking with John Hilsenrath, who's the chief economics correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, where he's responsible for covering the economy and the Federal Reserve. Well, of course, the president did talk about a grand bargain. This last fiscal cliff deal was pretty paltry. There's nothing grand about it. And it seems that our political system is incapable of dealing with our economic responsibility. The 14th Amendment solution in Paul Krugman's article, where he suggests that we should be ready to mint that coin, he says if the 14th Amendment solution declaring the debt ceiling unconstitutional isn't workable, then we should go with the coin. It's Bill Clinton, by the way, the former president of the United States, has suggested the 14th Amendment as a route as well. This may be silly talk, but it's silly talk in high circles.
The White House has looked at this the idea of a constitutional challenge and has ruled it out. And you know, one of the worries that they have with a constitutional challenge, and certainly with a $1 trillion platinum coin, would be not only the reaction of Moody's and S&P downgrading the debt, but the reaction of bondholders around the world. You know, if they see these kinds of approaches taken, they might stop buying government bond, U.S. Treasuries, and it could raise our interest costs substantially, which goes hand in hand with a compromise. I will offer one optimistic note to all of this. You know, the fact is we've gone through several iterations of these budget battles. We went through one in August 2011, and we just went through one again in December. And, you know, what you can say is that there has not been a grand bargain, a grand compromise, but there has been progress on several fronts. One is it started a conversation about the budget, which is a conversation that needs to be held. I should say a debate, and it's a hard debate. It requires difficult choices on revenues and spending, and it did lead to some permanent new stances on income tax rates, for example. And it led to some spending measures that were taken in August 2011. You could say that that these crises, as hard as they are to swallow and to watch, we are making some progress on moving towards some longer run fiscal sustainability through this. You could argue, if you want to take an optimistic light, that these kinds of landmines that the government has planted itself are necessary to force action.
Well, just in the last minute, John Hilsenrath, the president's basically said he's not going to negotiate like he did last time. He's simply not, right. You know, so they're going to have to blow up the government on their own.
Well, this is the interesting thing is, you know, both sides take hard lines. They took hard lines in the August 2011 negotiations. Obama, remember, said then he wasn't going to negotiate. They took hard lines in December, and somehow they managed to walk up to the very edge of that cliff and tiptoe back. It's certainly possible that they're going to play chicken too long this time. But if you look at what's happened the last couple of go-rounds, this is part of the art of negotiation: is you don't want to give up ground until the very last second when you have to.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, John Hilsenrath.
Okay, thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with John Hilsenrath, the chief economics correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, where he's responsible for covering the economy and the Federal Reserve. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and the conversation continues at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Me, an angel song about the home of the brave in this land.